You're listening to Distraction Therapy with Rob Watson. Conversations about how we find meaning in our lives and what it's like to be part of a meta-modern world. Hello, it's Saturday the 20th of August and this is a Distraction Therapy podcast with Rob Watson and...
Ryan Clayton, hello.
And we haven't been together for a few weeks, so we've probably got a lot to catch up on. And we're just in a coffee shop in Leicester as usual, so we've ordered our next coffee. So expect the kind of accelerated intensity of the conversation to progress as we as we get extra caffeinated.
As it slowly devolves into hyperactive nonsense.
Speak for yourself. I'm planning on just sitting back and relaxing. So yeah, my I've got my moaning out of the way first. So what have you been up to?
More than usual, to be fair, because I've had the past 3 days off and I've sort of I've got back into watching a few more films, reading a bit more. I started reading Bret Easton Ellis's novel Less Than Zero. I'm about halfway through that. Became fascinated by Gaspar Noé's films, so like Enter the Void, Irreversible, Love, Climax, just incredibly like provocative, challenging cinema that you really like, that you really feel.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Yeah, I mean, I love his films. I don't know if you've seen any of them.
It's not a name I know.
But I'd thoroughly recommend Irreversible and Climax. They just, you really feel, you're left with a very emotional reaction to them, like one of just disgust and horror and repulsion. I don't know how else to explain it. He makes films that you really feel that are sort of impossible because they're so shocking and brutal and oftentimes cruel. You can't sit there and watch them in a very detached sort of intellectual fashion, because there's always something else there to push you into an emotional bodily response. I mean, Enter the Void, for one, is fantastic because it's essentially all about embodiment. There's a guy who's living in Japan, an American guy. He's dealing drugs and he gets shot by the police. And the whole thing up to that point where he's shot by the police is filmed as if it were filmed behind his eyes. So you've got the blinks of his eyes, the movements of his head, the hallucinations as he smokes DMT, and then he gets shot by the police, which you really feel because it's just like a loud bang and you see like his chest burst open a little bit and he falls to the ground, and then the camera slowly starts to float above his body, and you're still in his perspective, but obviously like he's dead now and he's floating around the city of Tokyo and he's seeing the impact that his death has had on all of his friends. There's a point where he starts reliving his childhood memories and the death of his parents. It was very impactful. I'd thoroughly recommend it.
It's a nice, happy film to start the conversation off
yeah,
with.
Yeah, very cheerful.
Who is that again?
Gaspar Noé.
Right.
Argentinian-born French director, I believe. I'm trying to think. I know that some of his films at one point were on Netflix, because that's where I first watched Love, which is, again, quite a controversial film because about 60, 70% of it is unsimulated sex scenes. And it's essentially the story of this man's past relationship after he finds out that she's gone missing for 2 months and he's got a life now with somebody else and a child. And he's sort of replaying that very intense relationship back in his head. And because it's from the perspective of his memories, you're getting little glimpses and little snapshots from all over the place as you slowly kind of piece together and recontextualize over and over again the story of his relationship. and that the love story is told from a very like sexual point of view. So you're basically following their sexual relationship and how that changes over the course of their relationship. And it's essentially a meditation on what love is and how this man interacts with those feelings and that emotion and him discovering what it is. And it's really good for the purpose of the fact that there's not a lot of dialogue in it, and it doesn't give you any easy answers to any of the questions that it throws up in your face. At the end, you're left with a very somber, silent moment where he's sat by himself in the bathtub as the shower pours down on him, and he's just crying, and you're left there for about a minute with that before it eventually just says the end, and none of the questions that you
typically would want answered.
Yeah, exactly. And you're just sort of left wondering, like, okay, what was all that about? I just watched people fucking for like 2.5 hours, and I have all of these questions, and it's uncomfortable in that regard. A lot of his films are, because they're constantly pushing you to question and to look at things from a different perspective in often, like I said, cruel, shocking, violent ways. And then it doesn't really give you the answers that you want. Irreversible is a good one for that, because it's played in reverse, like Memento, but not crap. And then, so it begins with these scenes of this guy seeking very violent retribution and revenge, and it, of course, ends with him getting that, and the brutality of it all is so shocking. And because it's presented first, before you know why he's seeking it, you really have to sit there and reckon with the pure brutality of the violence before you're given any of the context.
I think I need do you watch these at home?
Oh yeah.
I find watching films domestically is okay than watching, you know, Die Hard or Pixar or something like that, which is fine. But if it was something that, you know, you've mentioned a few filmmakers that you highly recommend and that you're into, but I think it needs to be in a cinema where you can kind of go. Maybe we need to open a cinema in a small private members art cinema where you just go, you're going to put on your, what's your, there's the Russian guy and
Andrei Tarkovsky.
Yeah. You know, and it's like you every evening, you know, there's one of these movies on, which is,
that would be good.
Yeah, because I'm kind of the view. I look at, I suppose it's a question of a matter of commercial survival, but the art cinemas nearby are kind of following the pattern of the mainstream.
Yeah,
because
I think
it's quite difficult to access them sometimes, because they're not showing these. You're not in a little basement underneath a bar where there's a private cinema, you know, a kind of private member cinema where you can show all of these underground or retrospective. And it should be loads of them now, because you've got, you know, 4K Blu-ray type stuff.
It's easier than ever now to watch these films.
Just get a license, a film screening license.
I'm thinking the closest thing that we've got here in Leicester would probably be the Phoenix, right? Because they actually do show more of the like foreign and independent stuff when it comes out.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of that, like you say, like there's not a lot of the retrospective stuff, like, oh, this Polish film from the 1970s or whatever. But yeah, I know there's a cinema.
Plus, it's somewhere where you have to go to. It's not in the back of a neighbourhood, you know, kind of in a basement. You know, New York underground. I mean, literally, the phrase underground cinema comes from the fact that cinemas were, you know, in the basements of places, and it'd just be one screen and a few bench seats or something, and they'd project art films.
Well, maybe
stuff.
That can be the next project for us, Rob, after this radio station.
And then set up a cinema as well. So actually, it wouldn't be a bad idea, but it'd have to be, you know, it we'd have to
all you'd need is a projector and a Blu-ray player, surely.
Well, and some seats and a fire safety certificate, and
people can sit on the floor. This is getting bougie already, Rob.
Well, I think I'm past the age of sitting on the floor. Some bean bags or something. You could have half and half, you know, you could have bean bags.
You can bring your own camping chair. How about
that? Well, the hardest one, I worked at a cinema years ago, kind of back in 1992, I was back in Liverpool and I worked in a multiplex cinema. It was actually good fun. It was hard work, but it was good fun. I lost loads of weight because you had to tidy up. But the Friday night there was, I had like a alternative film screen, and so it was the one that I always used to get a good crowd in was The Wall. And then it stunk of weed.
I was going to say the Pink Floyd film, yeah. I'd be a bit alarmed if that film screening didn't stink of weed, actually.
It's like kind of like,
who's going to see that film sober?
Yeah, there's not much I could do about that. Just put the aircon on high, yeah. So it sucks it out, but it's you might get told off for that now. But yeah, we never had any trouble with that one.
Well, they just want to come in, watch the film, and just chill out, I suppose, don't they?
It starts about 11 o'clock and go through, you know, so you'd be leaving, you had a late show, and to go through, you'd leave about 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that.
Because I'm thinking, like, when you'd get like midnight screenings now, it's usually for films like The Room, and people will sit there and just scream and throw things.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine working at a cinema during that shift, cleaning up all of the like plastic spoons or something that they all throw during that film.
Well, yeah. I mean, the worst working day I think I ever had was Boxing Day 92, when Home Alone was out.
I love that you can remember the exact year.
Well, I do remember the year, but it was because it was the year before I came to Leicester, but it was Home Alone, and the place was just knee deep in absolute. You know, the kids were just running around crazy. They've been given, you know, it's probably a lot of the divorcees, you know, kind of giving their kids loads of sweets and everything. So they were running around, and it was like knee deep in popcorn and sweets and sick and everything. It was like you just couldn't do anything. You know, our job was to keep the place relatively clear, and this was just like chaos. It was like, my God, you know. But no, it's that kind of developing the habit of somewhere that's just, you know, you can go for a pint and then you can go watch a movie and there's no car park. So I think one of the things that kind of has killed cinema in a way is the fact that there's, you know, there aren't many cinemas now where they're not drive-ins, they've not got car parks, because it means that it's a destination that people then have to be attracted to. I mean, here in Leicester, I suppose, the Showcase doesn't have a car park, but it's part of a complex that has a car park and you can drive in.
Yeah, but I feel like people wouldn't really go to the Showcase unless they were coming into town anyway. Do you know what I mean? It feels like the kind of thing, because the car parking's so expensive. I mean, the nearest car park's the John Lewis car park, and the prices there are ridiculous. So if you're going to come in, you might as well, you know, go shopping, watch a film, get something to eat, make a day of it instead.
Well, we'll put a business plan together and we'll take over a disused shop, and in the basement we can do a cinema, and it's kind of, as you say, everything will be secondhand in it, and as long as we meet the fire regulations, then...
I'd love that. I've got lists and lists of really awful films I'd quite like to subject people to.
You can program it, yeah.
Brilliant.
So that took us away from talking about the film. What brought on this kind of intense recollection of the actual film itself? Obviously, it must have meant something. You know, you're watching these.
Yeah, well, I've only seen before I rewatched it. I only saw Irreversible the once, and it was a long time ago now. Years. I feel like it might have even been close to 10 years ago. But anyway, I saw it, and it seared itself into my mind because it was such a powerful film. The way in which it goes backwards through time, constantly recontextualizing the events that occurred before it, and in the middle there's a very controversial 9 minute long single shot rape scene that just seems to go on, and it's one of the most uncomfortable and horrific things I've ever sat through. And then, you know, you end on the more like conventional love story stuff where they're like, this couple's falling in love, and you're finding all these things out about them, like, oh, it turns out that she was pregnant, look how happy they were, and it keeps piling it on and piling it on. and it just gets sadder and sadder and sadder because you know exactly what happens, you know how the story ends, until at the end, the film just sort of ends with them lying, hanging out at a park, and they're very happy, unaware of what's to occur. And then on the screen, and Gaspar Noé does these like great things with like the typography of his credits and stuff, and so there's this like strobe effect and big block text, and it just says time destroys all things, and that always really stuck with me. And so like for 10 years I was like, you know, kept coming back to this film in my mind, thinking about it, and in the end I just thought, I feel like I was with my girlfriend and I had my laptop with me and I was like, oh, what film should we watch? And one of them was one of his films. It was Enter the Void I had on my laptop. And she said, oh, let's watch that. And so we did. And it was a very intense 2.5 hours. God. Absolutely not a date movie. But and since then, I've just sort of been like fascinated, because that's the kind of art and media that's always really interested me the most, the kind that really hits you on an emotional, bodily level, the kind that disgusts and repulses you and makes you think and doesn't give you any easy answers, but you can't look away. It's the same reason I started reading Less Than Zero by Bret Easton Ellis, because when I was at university, I read American Psycho. And that book, well, I feel like everybody reads American Psycho when they're at university, but it's the same kind of book, it's the same kind of approach, where it's almost relentless. It's the violence and the sexual violence in it is so intense and so relentless that, unlike something like Fight Club that attempts to deconstruct and critique these more toxic elements of masculinity, but ends up glamorizing it because it doesn't take it too far. Somebody like Bret Easton Ellis and Gaspar Noé almost take it so far that there's no way in which it could possibly be conceived as glamorous. It becomes so...
There's that great phrase, I think it was coined about the Velvet Underground, where they said, always leave the audience wanting less. It sounds like,
like
kind of violence. It's you get to that point where it is. It's just, you know, I suppose that's what reality. You know, it's more emotionally real than these kind of nicely tied up episodes, which are kind of, you know, resolved, moved on, yeah. Resolved, moved on, all tied up and explained at the end. Whereas like the futility of it all,
yeah,
is what you're left with because you can't answer it.
Yeah, and there's something great about the way in which the camera work and the editing, when I think about something like Fight Club, because it's so slick and perfect in its editing and the way it's shot, because that's just how David Fincher does his films, it can't help but be kind of glamorized, and you're looking at it thinking, oh, this is really cool. But then you watch something like, I watched Enter the Void last night, so it's fresh in my mind, but the camera is moving like, because his soul is floating above the city from this top down, and it keeps zooming into houses and through walls, and it's always moving in like these circular, like dizzying motions, to the point where like you're watching it and you just feel horribly nauseous, because you're watching it, all the lights are out, all you can see is the screen of the TV, and you're just left with almost motion sickness throughout the entire film. And there's no, and it's that attempt to make you feel something in your body, that nausea that lingers with you, as opposed to watching something like Fight Club, where you're sitting there and you can almost passively kind of soak it in and enjoy it.
There's a list of things that I want to watch, but I kind of feel when I'm watching them at home, it's a bit like, I just don't have the attention span for it, or the setting isn't right, or I'm not great at I think I've probably been put off by, I'm going to offend some people here, by the kind of film studies bores,
yeah,
you know, and it's kind of people who can tell you in intense detail, not for it tends to be from, if you like, a bit of a smart aleck perspective of knowledge about films. It's a bit like they know the back catalogue and they've looked through the BFI index and all that kind of stuff, and they can tell you about it in intense detail.
Yeah.
But it doesn't tell you, there's no relation to
I was going to say,
what it feels, what the embodied feeling is from this.
I was going to say, watch them squirm when you ask them how the film made them feel.
Yeah, you know, it's like, and what you have to feel something about this. It's just a catalogue of techniques. It's a catalogue of, you know, it's an auteur's work, and it's that, you know, it's interesting you say this because it reminds me of actually something that I kind of been looking at over the last couple of weeks, is more to do with this idea of metamodernism, and I've picked up the book Metamodernism, which I can't remember who the authors are, but it's from 2016, and I'll look on my phone in a second and try and find out who it is. And it's part of that, it's a bit laborious, it's a bit film studies-y, but one of the things that it talks about the metamodern turn is the incorporation of that Raymond Williams things of the structure of feeling, or culture of feeling, and that the idea that, it's Williams comes at it from a kind of post-Marxist kind of point of view, to say that we shouldn't just think about society as materialistic structures, but we also have to look at, you know, the feelings, if you like, that are generated through particular cultural moments, and that expression of what things fit, those things, though, you know, the feelings as in terms of the emotions, the senses that are brought forward, as much as the description and the categorization of these things.
I would argue more. It feels like that should be given a kind of primacy when you're dealing with these things, because I mean, if you're dealing with art, any kind of art, from like a very, like, you know, almost detached scientific way, where you're picking apart the method and the techniques and the camera angles and whatever, it feels like you're missing the overall point.
Well, for some people, that's where the pleasure is.
Mm.
You know, it's like taking a car apart. You know, you enjoy deconstructing the car and rebuilding it and looking at the manuals and figuring out how all the individual components work. But then somebody else is going to come along and go, well, I really like going out for a Sunday drive and having the windows open and the radio blasting. I don't care how it works. You know, and that interrelationship between the two, it kind of, we're dominated, I think, by the former, and the latter is kind of almost dismissed. So a lot of the movie making, the mainstream popular movie making, is to feed people who haven't thought about what that experience is of driving with the windows open and and the wind blowing through and the radio blasting on. They just do it because it's a ride. Mm-hmm. And that's what you, and a lot of our film, I watched one the other night, we did watch a cartoon thing in animation, which was on Paramount, because I've got that so I can watch the Star Trek stuff at the moment. Yeah. And
must be good. I feel like I'm looking at you struggling to remember the name.
Lucky, even. I think it's called. It's got Simon Pegg in it.
Is that the one with the cat?
Yeah, it's dreadful. Just awful. You know, it's just one trite thing after another, and, you know, no challenge, no real consternation. That, you know, no real kind of, you know, it's just everything's going to be positive and everything's going to be great. You know, it's kind of everything's wonderful and we've got all of this stuff going on. And it's like kind of there's no real moment in there where you think, well, there was one slight moment, but the rest of it is just like one series of, and it had to explain the series of events, the exposition. Oh, you need to go and do this, and then you need to go and do this, and then you need to go and do this. It was just a series of actions right the way through the whole film, which was just devoid of stories.
And why did you end up watching this film?
Because there was nothing else on. You know, it's like you're sitting there filming, it's like you either want to fill your head with something which is really serious that needs concentration, and in which case you then have to explain that to the person that you're sitting there watching it with. Why do you want to watch this? Because it's serious and heavy. And the second one, you know, it's easier to just go with something which is trite and light and, you know, you trip it. But, you know, they got bored with it as well and went off and did something else. So I was three quarters of the way through, so I thought I may as well finish it off.
Well,
you know?
I'll tell you what, because you've just reminded me, over recently, because I got very bored of looking through Netflix and not finding anything to watch. So I found out that there's like, what's the way to describe it? Like, what do you call them? You know, the people, are they publishers? The people that put out DVDs and like Blu-rays?
Publishers, yeah.
Yeah, but have you ever heard of, you know, Arrow Films? They put out a lot of and release a lot of cult stuff on Blu-ray. So stuff like, you know, like Terry Gilliam films,
right.
Like weird, like 70s, like Italian genre films, right. and stuff, and like horror movies. Well, it turns out I found out that they had a streaming service, which you might like, because there's a ton of really interesting stuff on there, and it ranges from like the like intellectually challenging to like schlocky.
You saying I need something intellectually challenging?
Well, no, but you were just complaining about it a moment ago. But yeah, and you've got stuff like the original Nosferatu and Carl Theodore Dreyer's Vampire.
Is the BFI? Is it cheap? Is it a cheap streaming service?
This one is at the Arrow streaming service that I've got was maybe like £5 a month,
right?
Which I didn't think was too bad. And there's tons of really interesting stuff on here. Like they've got Alejandro Jodorowsky's films on here, or three of them that I was telling you about before, like El Topo, The Holy Mountain, just like really vivid psychedelic films that you sit there and you're experiencing them and you don't really know what to make of your experience because everything is so... everything is symbol, and nothing really seems to tie those symbols within the text of the film. So you're just left there kind of interpreting and reinterpreting this constant barrage of symbolism that never really seems to tie itself up and make sense in an explicit way. Like, very interesting stuff.
I've been put off by film studies, so I kind of don't want to go back to another film. You know, it's almost like, you know, kind of if you want something which is a film experience and not an education, in that sense.
Well, that's what I'm saying. These films and that streaming service, that's what they're good for, because they're very much like the cult films that sit by the side of that traditional canon of cinema and are the ones that the reason they've become...
So you've used the word canon.
Yeah.
That's destroyed it for me. It's like...
But these aren't in the traditional canon, is what I'm trying to say. These are the ones that are interesting enough to stand on their own two feet, the ones that you really experience and are super memorable without being kind of laborious and tedious in an academic sense.
So the book I mentioned, because we're both sitting here looking at our phones, is... and I will look at Arrow streaming in a second, is... it's by... it's got one of those terrible titles, Metamodernism, Historicity.
That's close enough.
Effect and Depth After Postmodernism by Robin. It's edited by Robin van den Akke, Alison Gibson. I haven't got my teeth in, have I? Alison Gibbons, Timotheus. How do you pronounce? Would a Dutch person say Timothy?
No idea.
I'm presuming they're Dutch because their surname is Vermeulen. Oh, God.
People will be able to find it.
I wish I was one of those people. This is where I go wrong, you see. It's like kind of, I'd love to be erudite and be able to pronounce loads of foreign names. I can't. It's like, you know, it's like, but no. It's interesting. I mean, one of the things I was, I'm not quite ready to go full public with the radio station yet because we haven't quite got the final approval for the multiplex that still could.
Yeah.
Not happen, but the idea is that we may as well have a kind of preamble. And if anybody, this might genuinely link to anybody who listens to this. So this is like if you want to get in contact with us to help us to put together. So Ryan and I and another colleague of ours, Owen, are involved in developing a new community radio station, which hopefully. Fingers crossed would go on the new Leicester DAB multiplex, which might come into play in the next few months. And the idea is to put together an art-based station, which has three strands: emergent sound art, so music and sound art, civic discussion, and community stories. And it would be called Radio Lear. I'm learning to give
it's getting quite good, which
because King Lear is supposedly buried beneath below Leicester, and supposedly according to myth Leicester is Lear's castle. I think this is all mythological and it isn't really founded, and in fact there's a lot of contentious from what I've seen on online searches. Geoffrey of Monmouth took the myth and legend of King Lear, and then Shakespeare obviously turned it into something which has become much more resonant down the centuries. However, it's something which is, apart from a statue that's up at the Watermead Park, it really isn't part of the DNA of Leicester, that this 2,000 year old figure, King Lear, is resonant within Leicester's well-being. We've got King Richard.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know until you told me.
Yeah.
But I am extraordinarily ignorant.
But you are from Leicester, yeah. And it's well, okay. But yeah. it just shows you it isn't. You know, you'd think it'd be part of the DNA of the place. You'd walk into a shop and you'd find King Lear mugs and, you know, tea towels and stuff, yeah. But there isn't.
Well, you can go buy the play from Waterstones. And
well, apparently, you can, in the Waterstones in Leicester, you can't get a complete collection of Shakespeare's plays.
Can you not?
It is complete works, no. No, that you have to order it in. It's like, you know, it's
abysmal.
A city where you can't get that.
Yeah.
And so then... So everybody was telling me it's a terrible name. Yeah. So then I was kind of toying around with this idea and I thought, okay, well, it's got to be Leicester something, hasn't it? So, and then I thought, well, actually, there's a form of art, aesthetic experience, wherever, which is this metamodern notion of emergence. And, you know, what does that mean? Well, I'm not quite sure what it means, but it's the kind of stuff that we're talking about in terms of a more effective kind of approach to and sincere, this is the word that's been dropped in about metamodernism, this kind of return or reincorporation of sincerity as opposed to postmodern irony. So anyway, of course, so this is it a synonym, what was it when you put letters together to form I can't remember what that's
an
called
acronym?
An acronym,
yeah,
so it's Leicester Emergence Arts Radio. There we go. So it does what it says on the tin. So the idea is that we're going to develop this as a kind of fairly open process of curation of music and sound and with as little explanation and signposting as possible. And so conversations about cinema could be part of it.
Mm.
But, you know, and things that, you know, reference points to soundtracks or something like that, because I find soundtracks, I am interested, you know, soundtracks are probably one of the areas of kind of quite intense musical development which doesn't get a lot of credit, and there's a lot of crossover of contemporary artists who also do soundtracks and things like that, so it's yeah. A starting point. I've no idea where it's going to go and what it would be about, but I actually put in the application form that it's going to be a metamodern radio station. So, yeah.
Somebody's going to look at that and go, "What?"
But the idea is, it's like it's a hobby. It's an education without it being educational. I just want to get on to do something with it because I don't know the as you say the canon of contemporary film appreciation. I don't know artists, contemporary artists, musicians, that kind of stuff. It's kind of a blank to me. I don't know who these people are and what they're doing and why they're doing it. But isn't that an interesting reason to use this as a vehicle to find out and
yeah.
share that with other people?
100%. I think it'll be great. Any excuse for me to get on the airwaves and ramble about, I don't know, God knows, whatever it is I
film,
usually ramble
comics.
About. Yeah.
We haven't mentioned comics yet today. So.
No.
So we've got a persistent fly. It's like we're both getting quite annoyed at trying to push this fly
away. You know
away.
What it's it like, is? It's your bright orange shirt.
It's my aftershave.
Oh.
Yeah, that's probably where it's Oda Leicester.
You should not put any on like me and instead stink like shit because everybody else in this city does. No, so what's the point?
That could be applied to anywhere.
Yeah.
So I think any city that you go to in the summer, you know. So the notion then of if that encapsulates it, and I'm sure I can get it down to a bit more of a succinct kind of. I was telling somebody about it the other day, and they just looked at me blankly. It was like kind of, WTF? What are you talking about? You know? I was like, I'm just going to have fun with it. I just want to do something interesting. So.
To be honest, I think that's the main appeal of it, because it's been. there's like a specific mission statement, admittedly, which you've set out, but also at the same time, it's like...
I hope it's not a mission statement.
Well,
it's a starting point.
Yeah, that's what I mean, like in a sort of vague way, but it's still very open-ended and it leaves people a lot of scope to come and share things that they're interested in and engage in a conversation with other like-minded people or you know, people that are dissimilarly minded. I don't know what the antithetical phrase is to that, but, you know, so like somebody like me could come along and talk about comic books and film or whatever, or somebody else could come along and talk about history, or somebody else could come along and talk about, I don't know, geography or politics, whatever, you know, science, anything. And I think that's the appeal of it, is if once people start to like get a little bit more interested, you could find a sort of a variety of different viewpoints that could then all start to engage with one another on this platform, even if it's only engage with each other in virtue of the fact that they're on the same radio station. So, you know, you've got people listening in and they can tune in, and you know, you're not really quite sure what you're going to find. It could be a discussion one day, and then the next day you tune in thinking, oh, that was quite good, and you end up with this weird kind of avant-garde soundscapes or whatever, or like, you know, the algorithmically generated music that we've talked about before. And then, like you say, absolutely nobody there to tell you what to make of it. You can just sit there and experience it and decide for yourself.
I'm really glad that you summarized it in that kind of way, because your skills in writing that up are going to be essential.
Well, I'm always here, Rob,
when we set up the website, you're going to be doing all the text.
To be fair, I do write copy for a living.
Well, that's
so,
the idea, that's yeah. One of the advantages, you know. It's
but
like,
you know, my rates are quite expensive nowadays.
This is,
Rob.
This is your sweat labour for the CIC.
You're doing it for the exposure, am I?
You put your name down as a director of the CIC, that's the limit. But it's also on the basis of doing as little as possible. I mean, that's the other thing. And explaining as little as possible. I think that's the interesting thing. For once, I feel it's going to be interesting, because my perception is that 99 times out of 100, people ask you, you know, what's your mission statements, which kind of implies, where do you want to get to?
That there's a goal.
Yeah. And my view is that I have no idea. And as you say, I want to keep that as open as possible. There's a couple of things which are loose touchstones that you know that, you know, you've got to be compliant with the broadcast code. You've got to be respectful and inclusive of people to a limit. And you've got to be, you know, mindful that you do something which you're happy with yourself and as the group of people who are involved. Beyond that, I'm not explaining anything or giving any kind of certainty to anybody. I certainly don't want anybody to come along and say, well, I've heard this show on Radio 2 or Six Music or somewhere else. Can I do a version of that? In which case the answer is no, you know. There's plenty of other community stations that you can volunteer for where you can do that, you know. And the only thing I've been able to phrase it as, in a way, which is this notion of saying, well, what will arts and culture be like in 2040, 2050 here in Leicester, given the nature and the mix of Leicester? And I think it will take 10 years for us to get good at this, at which point I can retire and having spent the next 10 years talking to artists and authors and poets and writers and sound designers and filmmakers and all the rest of it, that we end up having this massive hobby of just talking to people who are maybe doing something a bit more interesting than just watching Netflix.
Yeah, and all of the crap that seems to be circulated on there.
But. Yeah, I think I've just got to... I kind of had a bit of a strop last night with me. I was like, I'm bored. Mm. Yeah, I've got Amazon, I've got Netflix, I've got Disney, because I quite like the Star Wars stuff, and I quite like the Star Trek, so I've now got Paramount as well. And it's like, but it's the only thing I'm doing. Yeah. You know, I don't. There's no pubs I go to in Leicester because I don't like drinking, and the pubs in Leicester tend to be, you know, the experience of going to a pub in Leicester.
You don't like the Market Tavern, Rob.
or Nine Bar, or wherever else. No, it's my days are going to pubs, but there doesn't seem to be anything outside of that. You know, it's if you want to go and listen to loud music and stand around a load of drunks, they're not really doing anything interesting.
Right.
And the wine bars, for example, the cheese and wine.
Do we even have one in Leicester?
There is. Yeah, there's a couple.
Oh, my.
But, it's like kind of, I wouldn't sit here and think, like at your salon, on a Friday night after a hard work making radio programs, that you're all heading to the salon and,
you'll have
and
to
discussing
set,
philosophy.
Well,
and,
you'll have to set one up.
Well, this can be, so the cinema complex.
Rob's Kitchen, everybody.
It'll be the weekly salon. Radio station, bookshop. Secondhand bookshop.
Okay.
Then cinema in the basement, cafe cum bar in the evening. I'm not bothered about if there's actually probably best if there's no alcohol. That'll put a load of people off that you don't want to. You can only drink coffee.
What, in the evening? We'd all never get to bed.
Well, at least it wouldn't be a load of drunken boars, it's like,
well, what you'd have to do is serve people like the odd glass of wine. Give everybody one glass of wine and that's it.
Yeah.
No more.
Yeah, maybe restrict it to
depending on how long it's going on for, one, two glasses of wine. I'll down a bottle before I come, it'll be fine.
Yeah. And then members only.
Keep out the riffraff.
What's your fantasy arts venue? I worked at the Corner House in Manchester at one point, which is the arts venue, which is there now. I think it's been replaced or part of Home, which is the big arts venue there, which I've only had the chance to get there once. And but it was like it did have this kind of it was good because it was the cinema had this appeal. So the cinema was actually in the base, literally in the basement, and across the road there was so it's at Oxford Street Station. That's where it was based, on Oxford Street in Manchester. And the cinema there, the big cinema, we always used to have this joke that when they put Paris, Texas on, like every 3 months it was on, and you'd open the box and the letters would jump out onto the signage outside the front, those things that you hang the letters on. They would just jump up because it had been on so many times. But it did do some interesting films, but not that I ever got the chance to go and see stuff or much. Yeah. But the art galleries were above it, and the cafe in the middle was quite a trendy, vegetarian cafe at the time and stuff like that. And I kind of miss that because it's... I think now it's... I don't know whether the Phoenix and Leicester will have that kind of vibe once it's expanded and reconfigured its restaurants, but I kind of, kind of cultural quarter elements of Leicester is kind of like the Curve and people driving in from Market Harbour to go and see a touring production or a King Richard.
Yeah.
You know,
well, that's all there is.
From the National Theatre and stuff.
The cultural quarter's a bit... Like, what is it? What
deflated, dissolving before our
it's
eyes.
It's hardly a quarter, is it? You've got the Curve and you've got the Phoenix, and the rest is just like dilapidated.
I suppose it comes from this notion that, what is culture? And the notion of culture has become something which is we put in place those things which are part of the economy and not part of people's lived experience. So when you look around and you ask people to consider what. How would you describe, just look around the room we're in now, how would you describe the culture of a place like this? What would you say would be the, when you look back, epochs and eras, and you can over-romanticise these kind of things, kind of Berlin in the 1930s or Paris in the 1890s or, London in the 1960s.
Yeah.
You're not going to get it from... There is a kind of vibe and a structure of feeling towards everyday common culture. And there's different... Somebody, I was explaining the idea of the radio station to somebody, said, so you're an elitist. I was like, yes, of course. But what's wrong with being... I'm not sure why I'm an elitist. Maybe, what's the word I'm looking for? I hate the phrase avant-garde, and those people at the cutting edge, all that kind of stuff, because that often is self-promotion and restriction and making things narrow. I'm not really interested. This is about opening this up. So the kind of films that you're talking about, it's about having common conversation. Easily, not. I can wrap myself up in loads of little kind of twists and turns with this, but whilst the topic that you're talking about might be challenging, the way that you go about it doesn't have to be restricted to a particular kind. That's why I'm actually really not bothered that my pronunciation of theorists is so bad, because actually that's a badge of pride for me in many ways. You know, I remember learning to pronounce Baudrillard's name properly, but you know, the first time, I can't even say it wrong now.
Well, I mean, I don't really.
Baudrillard or something like that. When you start off, you know, and it's like, all of these words, but there's a middle class kind of expectation that you somehow should know how to pronounce every bloody name of every political theorist or, you know, thinker over thousands of years and pronounce them in the vernacular. As you know, kind of, and know how to do that. It's like, no, I don't come from that kind of background where I never learned that kind of. You know, we had Smith and Jones and Watson and and Clark, and it wasn't much more. You know, it's very kind of guttural English.
And it does annoy me a little bit as well, because the only way in which you learn how to pronounce these names like correctly is if someone's told you. But if you've sat there on your own, like I've got a friend who is very interested in philosophy and has did a little bit as a course of his English degree, but not too much, but has since gone on to read like quite a bit of Heidegger and like postmodern thinkers and all sorts, really. And sometimes he can't pronounce the names because, of course, nobody's told him. He's just sat there in his room and he's read
like
the books.
Goethe, you know, Goethe. You know, you look at it and you kind of, how do you pronounce this?
I've no idea.
As far as I know, it's Goethe. But
I always just say Goethe.
Yeah.
Because that's.
I think it's about claiming that kind of, pulling that back in and saying, look, you know, it's not a question of what you understand. Just because you don't have a reference point for, you know, like Foucault, that took me years to learn how to say that.
Well, I only learned it again because I was sat in a philosophy class and somebody literally, the name pops up on the presentation or whatever, and they go, today we're going to talk about Foucault. And it's like, oh, okay. That's
See,
how you say that
like, you say Foucault and I say Foucault. And it's like kind of, oh, well, you know, you're not quite getting it right. So I don't
To be honest, at this point, I couldn't even hear the difference, and I'm not going to suggest one of us is right and one of us is wrong.
But you do get that kind of snobbery that comes into this. You know, there is that. You know, that's how you police a cultural elite.
Yeah.
About the people who are obsessed about the pronunciation of names and words, not about the level of understanding and the value that places that somebody really takes from what this person's saying. It's all about the appearance of being, you learn the tricks of appearing to be erudite.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really test people.
Well, because a lot of the times that's what is often mistaken for intelligence or like thoughtfulness. As long as you can pronounce the things correctly and repeat the correct talking points in the right way, then you're seen as intelligent. But if, God forbid, you sit there and admit you don't know something, or you've not read something, or you've not watched this particular film,
it's like that cultural currency, isn't it? You know, it's kind of, exactly, you soon run out of it and you're bankrupt. So this, you know, the idea would be, so from that point of view, whilst I'm an elitist when it comes to the aspiration of trying to do something interesting, I'm not an elitist in terms of, I'm quite democratic in terms of the way that people get into that space to do something.
Yeah.
But I'm just bored a lot of the time with what people have already come up with and what people try and pass off as being of any kind of cultural value. I think there's an awful lot of it. How do you destroy... there's an interesting one. So I wrote a blog the other day, last week, about... this notion of emergence, and I'd read Jung's chapter in Man in Search of a Modern Man in Search of a Soul. He wrote a chapter about literature, poetry, and art, and aesthetic appreciation. and he divides it between, it's a really nice simple distinction. I was kind of, I'll use this as the kind of the main reference point for what, for what, how to explain things. And he says there's, there's two types of aesthetic artistic endeavor, if you like, and I'll probably explain it really badly. So the first one is the psychological, where when you engage with a piece of art or a text or a poem or something like that, what you spend a lot of time doing is trying to understand the psychology of the artist. Why did this go into this? What does this tell you about them and the world that they come from, the collective world of aesthetic understanding, common ideas, that kind of stuff? And you're trying to understand the psychology of the age. He said, and then there's the, so people would read Melville and, you know, kind of Moby Dick and stuff, you know, as a, or who did Heart of Darkness?
Joseph Conrad.
Yeah, so yeah. It's, you know, that kind of thing where you've really got this intense trying to develop an understanding of the psychological, you know, Bret Easton Ellis, you're trying to understand the psychology. And then he says there's another kind of art, which is the visionary kind of art. So you get people like Blake, where you just don't have a clue what's going on. And he says you need to call for a commentary because there's just, it doesn't make sense, or it confounds you, and you walk away from it. You know, you kind of don't know how to make sense of it, and it can be highly problematic. It can be disgusting. It can be confusing. It can be all of these things which you can't put into a framework and say, this fits within these, this was the motivation of the artist, because what they're actually employing is something that transcends our particular experience of the moment, our particular cultural structure of feeling of now, and they're actually offering something which they even can't explain.
Yeah,
it's almost like a kind of mystical transcendent state of these artists, which they go in and do something in their poetry, and yet somehow, over time, we begin to make a sense of it. We begin to understand what they've brought forward, if you like, that they've touched on. And I thought that was a kind of really nice division between, I mean, there's probably lots of other ways to look at this stuff, but it was kind of that emergent notion. So, you know, understand the psychology of something, and that film studies description of very concrete kind of way of analysing things, thinking about the auteur, the director, the focus on that. It's very much concrete. But then you've got those filmmakers where you kind of sit there and you go, I'm just completely confused by all of this. What's going on? You know?
Yeah. So I don't know what to add to that.
Well, it's just, you know, we live... when was the last time you spoke to somebody or you experienced it yourself that you had a moment where you were kind of either confounded by a piece of an aesthetic experience or a piece of what we might loosely call art or literature or poetry or drama or anything like that, whatever you want to call it, I don't know, creative practice, where you've gone, but it's meant something to you. On reflection, you kind of keep going back to it. I mean, you mentioned that about the film,
I think it was probably when I watched Love, to be honest, for the first time, because like I said, you sort of get pulled through this whole film, and it's like, you know, you're piecing together the jigsaw of his previous relationship, and then at the end it just sort of ends, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, what on earth did that mean? But then, like, the more that it sits with you, because you sat there and you experienced it instead of picking it apart, it kind of seeps in, and you slowly, like with a puzzle box that you can't quite figure out, you're slowly sliding the pieces into the correct place, and you're like, oh, okay, and the answers start to become a bit more obvious over time. But like I said, and a lot of this Gaspar Noé's films are like that. Like, you sit there at the end and you go, well, absolutely no idea what that was about. Lux Aeterna was another good one, and the film's only 50 minutes long. And you sit there at the end, and because it feels like it ends so abruptly, like everything is ramping up constantly, ramping up and up and up, until it sort of ends in this relatively sustained audio-visual attack upon your senses that you can't quite make sense of. And it ends, and you're like, well, I absolutely no idea what that meant. But then you let it sit with you, watch it again, and it just starts to make a bit more sense.
I just, the simple description I have, it's like a those say it's like a glass of whiskey that, you know, kind of the first time you taste it, it's like sour.
Yeah.
But then an hour later, when she's sipping away, it suddenly expresses itself within you as a kind of different experience. Mm. Because it's kind of, you're allowing that emergent experience rather than looking at what the outcome is, looking at what the goal is, looking at what you should be feeling this. You know, a mainstream Hollywood movies designed around the idea that you know what you want the audience to feel,
yeah,
and that there's a satisfaction, whether it's, you know, a kind of sense of superiority, a sense of completion, a sense of emotional resolution, whatever it is, that comes from watching a narrative which is kind of churned out, like paged. Yeah. And there's a function to that. It works very well in a mass, industrially produced kind of content kind of way. But I think I've reached that kind of saturation point with all of this, and I need to kind of maybe step into a different domain.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why I like, you know, I've always enjoyed going for a walk and listening to music or a podcast and putting headphones on, because it's, you know, it's about getting out and about, and if you go out for a 2 or 3 hour walk or something like that, and you're listening to stuff, you experience it in a different way, because that you're not just sat at home. And I find I used to listen to a lot of radio dramas. Okay. In that way, I used to go for walks, and I think I listened to the BBC Shakespeare collection one summer, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you know, very, very evocative and very well done, but your listening mode changes rather than just sitting there watching a screen. I find that quite challenging these days.
Yeah. The attention span's been absolutely destroyed.
Well, I don't know whether it's the attention span. I think it's just the lack of... I'm very judgmental. If something comes on and I don't like the first couple of minutes, I turn it off. I mean, what did we watch the other day? There was something that came on. Oh, this one again. It's one of those things on Paramount. It's about this sinkhole in Los Angeles that opens up and it pulls all these people through into an alternate reality. It's a bit like Lost kind of stuff. And the first 20 minutes was just awful. It was just, you know, by numbers. You know, the worst. There was no. All of the characters were just painted very, very quickly in these broad brushstrokes of that's the teenage son who does this, that's the teenage daughter who does this, that's the divorced mom who does this, that's the dad who does this. And it's like kind of, and it was trite, and it was like, you know, there was nothing in between these very like plastic Lego building blocks of different colours. And it was just awful. We watched it for about 20 minutes and said, this isn't very good, is it? And turned it off. But I also hate making those quick judgments, because maybe I do need to get back into watching some forms of cinema. But I have to prepare myself for that and put the time aside and go, you know, like, okay, this is 2 hours of me watching a movie.
Yeah.
And that just feels like I get itchy.
Maybe you need to watch, like, I mean, this is why that streaming service I recommended to you is quite good, because the stuff is curated, and there is some stuff on there that's like, you know, very challenging and you have to really sit there, but there's also some stuff on there that's just really good, but also at the same time as it being really good, it's also kind of junk, but it's good junk. So like, I'm trying to think of an example. There's some like 70s Italian westerns on there that are very interesting, but also just filled with, yeah, that's the one.
The home of cult cinema.
Mm.
Okay.
I don't know if it'll, it might be worth checking first if you can get it on your TV, because I have to watch it on my laptop and like plug the HDMI in through it, because I couldn't get the app on my PlayStation, and I don't have a smart TV.
Right.
But I think some smart TVs you can get the app on it.
Oh, I'll have a look.
But and there are some great things on there. Like The Happiness of the Categories is on there, which is this very strange Japanese horror comedy that's also a musical about people who, there's like some stop motion elements in it. There's this like.
Do you write about your film? Appreciation?
No. I've been told I probably should, but I just don't think. I'm quite bad for stuff like that, like settling on a single topic and deciding what I want to write about and then, you know, organising the thoughts in such a way that they make a satisfying
essay. Well, even if you just make a note and say, I watch this tonight and I watch that, and you put a link to it.
Yeah.
might be worth, or put a tweet out or something. So
it's not a bad idea, actually. At the very least, maybe keep a journal or something.
Just to log it, because I think, you know, having that different perspective, and I think it's very much an individual and personal perspective, but it's non-institutionalized. I think film appreciate, and I suppose it applies to any art and culture, is that when it becomes institutionalized, it kind of loses something. Whereas, you know, you're trying to work in a de-institutional, I mean, maybe the radio station is one of the things we have to be wary of, is that there will be some partners that will be institutionalized. In both senses of the word.
I just heard that.
And then there'll be people who will similarly have been kind of structured, their understanding of art and culture will be through the structure of institutions and that interrelationship. And whereas this is, you know, the culture of art, well, there's probably loads of stuff that's going on around, you know, all, you know, everywhere, that just doesn't get talked about because it doesn't fit in within those institutional boxes that have been, you know. And, you know, at some point we want to try and bring funding into this, so it, you know, it might have to be formalised at some point, but we can go through a process and a period of exploration and dissolving the boundaries between those institutional expectations and looking at their, you know, how does the interesting thing, I mean, just a kind of quick observation, is looking at this new Lord of the Rings stuff that's coming out on, to work on something like that on kind of television, which is taking reference points from cinema, is the literary capability of the writers in terms of, and I take my hat off to modern television writers, you know, whether it's streaming or broadcast television.
Yeah.
Their understanding and ability to work with the dramatic form is pretty impressive.
It is,
sometimes.
Yeah. I guess it helps as well, like, you know, when you're working on something like that, something that big, you'll have a massive team of writers. Well, maybe not massive, but you'd have a team of writers, wouldn't you? So it's the case of, like, you're all pooling your intelligence and your areas of expertise and the things that you're good at. And I'd imagine that after a time of working with one another, you'd become aware of that. And these things are all very thoroughly planned and researched.
Well, that's what we'd like to think. I mean, I suppose there's an awful lot of stuff out there that is just done by rote.
Yeah,
and it's just 100%. Done, you know, to a press release type pattern. Yeah. You know, it's kind of press and PR type pattern. You churn it out. Where you do know that, you know, a publishing house has a couple of authors that it says, now let them do, you know, like filmmakers, let them do what they want to do.
Yeah.
I was watching some stuff about Stanley Kubrick last night and some of the films that he'd not produced.
Yeah.
But the amount of development work that went into it. And it's like, you know, you need...
because wasn't Napoleon?
Napoleon, yeah. And he was going to do one about the Holocaust. But on each occasion, it kind of just didn't work out quite right. And he did lots of pre-production work and stuff like that. But, you know, so you're always in this situation where that is quite fragile. And I suppose for me, it's just, I'd just like to know what's kind of going on and who's doing it. And can we talk about what's going on and who's doing it in a way which isn't overly structured in terms of radio as signposting and personality and boundaries between types of program, and this is a film program, so it's got to be presented in this way, and this is an arts program, so it's, you know, that BBC clear delineation of what types of programming they do. It's like, forget, can we sweep away some of these boundaries and make it more fluid?
Well, yeah, whereas, like, you know, you have a couple of people come on, like, I mean, I suppose, like, this in a sense, and they have a topic of conversation, let's say, maybe just to give them like a good starting point, and then you just allow that to go wherever it goes. Like, you could start off talking about, I don't know, something that's recently happened in Leicester or like some event or whatever, and then before you know it, they've wandered on to film, to art, back to politics, and then history,
that,
or whatever.
It's that journey of emergent experience. There's a film I was watching, flicking through YouTube last night, and there's a film, The Lost King, which is about the discovery, it's a British film about the discovery of the King Richard's and part of it is shot in Leicester. A lot of it isn't by the looks of it, but it's about the archaeological team at University of Leicester who, but it's been turned into a feel-good movie, you know.
Oh, right.
It's okay. Got Steve Coogan's in it. And
Steve Coogan's
yeah, in it? Yeah, yeah, he's got a role in it as the husband of the I can't remember the woman's name who did it, but it's... So it's got that kind of...
I thought he'd be playing the corpse of King Richard III, no?
I don't think so, but the comic relief. But he... But yeah, that's coming out soon. So. Mm. And it, yeah, you know, it's like just. But that for me, is kind of very much kind of looking backwards. It isn't really breaking any new ground.
No,
it's breaking old ground. It's archaeological. I mean, somebody can convince me that there's a way to look at archaeological issues in a new way. Then come on, please do talk about it. But let's.
Well, neither of us know anything about archaeology,
Yeah. Exactly. So they can educate us.
Easy to sit here from a position of ignorance, isn't it? It's actually quite nice.
But it's also quite nice to sit there and say, come and talk about it, because, you know, we want to learn about it, we want to know about it, if it's relevant. And, you know, what will archaeology in Leicester be like in 30 years' time?
Yeah, and it's just, it's nice sometimes as well just to talk to people that are passionate about things, because that passion is often a bit contagious. It rubs off on you.
Yeah.
And you find yourself interested in things that you never thought you would be interested in.
Right. Anything that you want to add that you don't think we've covered?
Oh,
or anything you want to retract that we have covered?
I would like to retract everything I've said. Those aren't my opinions.
Hard luck. Okay, how do people get in contact with you?
I'm on Twitter under at Clayton Comics with an X on the end.
Cool. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Rob W Media. And if you go to the website, robwatsonmedia.net, you'll find past episodes of the podcast, which is up on iTunes and Google and things like that as well. And if, that'll do for now. So until next time, watch out for the Radio Lear stuff. We'll probably start putting stuff out at some point in the next couple of weeks or months or whatever it is. So it's a nice dream to have. You've been listening to Distraction Therapy with me, Rob Watson. Find out more at robwatsonmedia.net or follow me on Instagram and Twitter at robwmedia.